access number 28672, Mr. Tony Bradbury, Real 7. Now, what was your reception? You were going to see the electrical officer, the engineering electrical officer.
Well, the engineering electrical officer, which was, of course, a naval officer, his name was Lieutenant Pegler. And he was a very nice bloke. I always got on very well with him. And he said, well, we want somebody on the air staff, he said. He said, you won't be joining one of the squadrons. He said, we've got two squadrons on board. One is 814 Squadron, which has two-seater Fireflies. And one is 802 Squadron, which has Seafires. He said, but we're not going to put you on one of those. He said, you're going to join the air staff.
Now, what's the air staff?
Well, people who go around and generally assist both these squadrons. In case anybody falls sick or anything like that, the air staff lend one of their people to that squadron until he returns, or they get somebody else from England to go on draft, that sort of thing. So he said, you'll join the air staff for a bit. He said, by this time I'd got promotion, I'd become a leading air fitter. So I got that at Melksham before I left. That was in about September 45. I'd done 2 years then in the electrical branch. So I got, by that time, if you pass all your various trade tests and you your results were all right, you became a leading air fitter.
So what were your duties on when you were posted on the air staff? What do you remember?
Well, much the same as I'd done when I was at Melksham.
So the daily and weekly inspections?
Same routine, daily and weekly inspections. But of course we had to do a lot more, because when we went to sea and did deck landings, some of the pilots, shall I say, varied in capacity. So there'd be a lot more repair work to do, especially for the airframes people. But sometimes for the electrical people, because if an aircraft landed and hit the barrier as it was in those days, and became a bit of a wreck, the aircraft would be pushed forward of the barrier, ready for the next aircraft, and then we'd be given about half an hour to pull off as many bits as we could, cannibalise the aircraft, and everybody would descend on this aircraft, mainly the air staff people, and we'd just pull out the blind flying panel and all the instruments and as much gear as we could get off in about a quarter of an hour. The engine people would take off any bits they could get off. The airframes people would do the same. And then if the aircraft was so badly damaged that it wasn't capable of repair, it would just be pushed over the side. So that's mainly our air staff duties. We used to have to do this sort of thing. And we used to have to do quite a bit of it, because quite a few aircraft got damaged on deck landing and got scrapped as a result.
Any other duties?
Well, I used to help help the airframes people, because I was interested in airframes from my previous experience. So one of the things I used to do was if an aircraft landed and it's nose down rather, and its propellers hit the deck, and they weren't too badly damaged, we were allowed to cut off about 6 inches of the propeller and repair the propellers ready for the aircraft's next flight. If I hadn't got any work to do, I used to help out doing this. And the wooden propellers of the Seafires, they were the main ones we used to have to repair. If my memory serves me, we didn't do so much on the Fireflies because they had metal propellers, and they used to get bent up quite a bit, and we never used to bother with those very much. But the wooden propellers, if I remember rightly, they were fitted to the Seafires, and we used to repair these, and the Seafires would fly again. And of course, they wouldn't be so prone to damage, because if the pilot made a bit of a heavy landing, as we call it, and he came in nose down, rather, the ends of the propeller would tend to miss the deck. So those were the sort of things we used to do on the air staff.
What was your mess deck like there?
Well, because it was a wartime light fleet carrier, built in rather a hurry, it was, again, very basic. And there were about 40 of us used to live in this... Well, I'll go ahead a bit first. When I was in the air staff mess, that wasn't too bad because it was right down near the quarterdeck, so we didn't experience too much bad weather. And mainly the permanent ship staff, I distinguished between them and the air staff, because when we used to arrive at a place like Singapore, all the air staff people and aircraft would disembark and go to Sembawang Air Station and carry on flying from on land. But the rest of the ship staff, the seamen, the stokers, all those and the writers, all those people, those sort of people, would continue on the ship. So obviously, because they were on the ship the whole time, they had the best messes. But for some reason, this air staff mess wasn't very large, which was down near the quarterdeck, was quite good, except that because the ship had been built in a hurry in wartime, there were about 10 of them built in a hurry after the loss of the Prince of Wales and the Repulse. They realised then, I think, that the battleship was over and that the future war would be run in by aircraft, mainly. Well, anyway, the air staff mess was not too bad, a bit basic.
Were you in hammocks or bunks? Or?
No, we used to all live in hammocks. We used to sling our hammocks over the mess tables.
And how did you take to hammocks? Had you had them before?
No, I'd never experienced a hammock before. I'd always lived in one of these primitive sort of beds that they knocked up quickly for a large number of people. But I had to learn how to sling a hammock and how to adjust it in the mornings, tie it up.
This
sort of thing.
Quite uncomfortable.
Yeah, very comfortable. Yes, I like to have it better than the bed, really.
Now, how long we? Oh, the food. What was the food like?
Patchy. We shortly after I got there to Venerable, it seemed that the supply ship had got delayed or got lost or something, so we ran short of fresh meat. So for quite some time, for about 3 weeks, our meat ration was, I say eked out, but it was mainly corned beef. And that was really my main hardship, I must say, in all my time in the Navy, living on more or less corned beef for about 3 weeks.
Which messing system was it?
Well, we used to, they were changing over then from cook of the mess systems.
That's perversely called canteen messes.
Yes. They used to have canteen messing, and but then by that time they'd got a separate sort of almost like a little galley attached to each mess. But the cook of the mess used to go there and get the food from the main galley, and then distribute it out to the to all the others by means of a hatch, and then passing the food out to the rest of his comrades, really. And we all used to have to take it in turn to be cook of the mess. Go and get the whole meal in big mess tins, and then dish it out.
Now, did you stay long with the air staff, as they call it, the general, or you?
No, because
one of the other squadrons.
Because by that time, being pretty ambitious, I decided I wanted to become a petty officer. So I looked up the regulations, and I found out that after you'd been a leading air fitter for a year and you hadn't got into any bother, you could apply to become an acting petty officer after a year. So in September, I applied for that. And much to my surprise, I got it. So I became a petty officer, and of course, I had to shift out of the leading rates mess, the other mess I was in, and go up into the petty officers mess, and they contained all the petty officers for the two squadrons, and also for the air staff. They were all in one big mess together.
And you were still air staff?
No, by that time they said, you've got to join one of the squadrons.
So which one were you posted to?
I went to 814. So after that time, I mainly worked on Fireflies.
Now, what any problem, anything you want to say about the Fireflies and aircraft, you know, the problem?
Well, the Firefly was... By the time we'd gone on like this for a couple of months, doing our flying from Trincomalee, going out for days and doing deck landings, all that sort of thing, we were running a bit short of aircraft because we'd got very badly damaged. So a ship had to be sent out with a load of replacements, and we got replacements which we got. We checked before we left Trincomalee and put them onto the aircraft carrier, and we got a new complement of Fireflies before we left Trincomalee. And then, as I remember, we're on the voyage up to Hong Kong then, when I went to the captain's table to get promoted, and fortunately I did, so I had to haul my gear out of the old air staff mess, and then go up to another mess which had all the petty officers in it of all sorts. Some of them were flying crew as well, observers, and all the various trades for the aircraft for both squadrons and the air staff, but they put me on to 814 squadron. And after that, when we got to Hong Kong, we followed much the same routine as we'd done in Trincomalee, which was going out for days flying, all that sort of thing. But by that time there were four aircraft carriers: the Theseus, the Glory, one other carrier whose name escapes me, and ourselves, the Venerable. And so we always used to go out and get as many aircraft service as possible. Of course, there was a big competition amongst the aircraft carriers to see who could get most aircraft flying, most serviceable aircraft flying. I was always being pestered, we need 10 today, we must have 10. So we'd have to work practically all night to get 10 aircraft ready, and then the air crew in the morning would take over the aircraft. They'd be struck up on deck by means of the lift, and they would go off for their various exercises. And in the two-seater aircraft, they'd have a pilot, who was of course a commissioned officer, and an observer in the rear seat of the aircraft. And those observers were mainly petty officers who used to live with us in the in my new mess deck. And I must say that one of them I respected very greatly, because I got pally with him, and I always realised his pilot was a bit erratic. And I always remember he always used to look very worried on lining up his aircraft on the flight deck. What's going to happen next? Because he wouldn't know what sort of landing the pilot was going to make. And is he going to overshoot and land in the sea? Or is he going to take off and hit the water? He was always worried about what his pilot was going to do. And knowing his pilot and seeing the way he operated, I don't blame him. Because several of the pilots were good, and several were considerably less good. And he was with a pilot all the time who was considerably less good. And he was always very apprehensive when his turn came to sit in the aircraft, take off, and then of course fly around and do the various exercises and then land on again. But I must admire him because he stuck it. And I was great friends with him because he taught me spherical trigonometry, which I've completely forgotten now. But anyway, in the evenings we had a radio, because there's no television in those days. We all used to sit around in the mess in the evenings and play accas and things like that, and play cards. And this bloke took it upon himself to instruct me in spherical trigonometry, and I was very grateful to him because it was another subject. But he got demobbed when we came back to England eventually.
Now, hang on. What happened next? You're off Hong Kong exercising with the other aircraft carriers.
Yes.
What happens next?
Well, we used to come back at night and get ready for perhaps the next day, have another exercise. We wouldn't set at sea all night unless a typhoon blew up. And at that time of year, late September, October, November, the weather was very, very bad.
What were the typhoons like?
Bloody awful. And if we were in harbour and a typhoon threatened, we'd have to go out to sea because it was considered safer. Because in Hong Kong Harbour at that time, I can remember seeing on one of my sightseeing missions, we'd see ships blown up on the shore. Some of them had been there for years. And we realised that if in the confined spaces of Hong Kong Harbour, our ships had started to drag their anchors or anything like that, we could well wind up in the same position. So every time a typhoon threatened, which was quite often, we used to have to go to sea and spend time at sea until such time as the weather moderated, and when we come back in harbour again. And I remember one particular typhoon, and that really did frighten me. I thought the ship was going to capsize. And I said to, there's one naval constructor there who I knew reasonably well as also, and I was chatting to him. I said, "This ship is going to capsize." He said, "Don't you believe," he said, "it can do worse than this before it does." Oh, thank you very much. But anyway, we used to get messages like, "The ship will now commence to roll heavily," where we had to change course. And we did roll heavily. And I was thinking of all the aircraft shackled down in the hangar. Are they going to break loose and start breaking through the bulkheads? But they never did, because they were really well secured, because we used to shackle the aircraft down very well in the hangar. And but the typhoons were quite an experience, I can tell you.
Anything else about your time out in Hong Kong?
Well, sightseeing again. I used to go, another friend of mine, we used to travel around and visit the new territories, as they were called. We used to land in Hong Kong Harbour, Victoria, get the civilian ferry over to Kowloon, and then we start hitchhiking, which in retrospect was a rather dangerous occupation, but we never came to any harm. So we used to cycle, we used to hitchhike all round the new territories. I remember one time we landed up near a monastery, and I believe it was a particular brand of Buddhism that this monastery was in support of. And one of the monks saw us wandering round and said, I'll show you around the monastery. So we got shown around this monastery, and he was very helpful. He spoke quite good English, I'm glad to say. And I was surprised because the, shall we say, the religion seemed very close to Christianity to me. It had a heaven. It had all sorts of hell, and very much on the lines of Dante's Inferno, I believe. And the hell, we got, he was describing to us the various hells we could go into, just depending on how wicked we'd been in life, you see. But anyway, that was very interesting. We came out of that monastery and walked down the road again, and a lorry drew up, and it was one of the people on who were the aircraft people, not the aircraft people, the army people who were then back in the new territories, and said, do you want to lift, blokes? Yeah, so we want to get back to Kowloon. Jump in. So we got back to Kowloon. But my main impression of Hong Kong was on Christmas Eve, 1946, because it was Venerable's turn to supply the shore patrol, and we had to supply a shore patrol to try and preserve some sort of order in the China Fleet Club in Victoria, in Hong Kong. So there were about 10 of us, as I remember. I was one of them. And in my newfound status as a petty officer, I was petty officer of the patrol. And we had a naval officer who was in charge of the patrol, and about 10 others who had to scatter around the China Fleet Club and try and preserve some form of order. Well, we got to China Fleet Club about 3 o'clock on Christmas Eve afternoon, and heavy drinking was already taking place. And I remember I went into the bar, and there was a three-badge able seaman sitting there. And at that time, he must have done at least 13 years, because he's got one badge at 3 years, two badges of 8 years, and one at 13 years. It was changed later. But anyway, he was sitting there, and I looked at him. He was sitting in the corner quite comfortably, not saying anything to anybody. And he was drinking some liquid. In the end, I said to him, that beer's a funny colour. He said, not beer. I said, what then? Sherry. Sherry? I said, you get well and truly stoned on that. So he gave me the time-honored reply, not many, Benny. But anyway, I didn't take any much more notice of him, because he was not causing any trouble. And sherry was extraordinarily cheap there, and I was surprised how quickly Hong Kong had recovered from the Japanese occupation.
So was there any trouble with the shore patrol?
Yeah, not half. I'm coming to that. Because the bar was full of people getting into various stages of drunkenness. And a bit after that, somebody called me and said, you'd better come up to the snooker room. So I went up to the snooker room, and I found that from the Gurkha garrison who were there back after the time, and some of the naval ratings from the different ships. They started off quite friendly, but they decided to have a game of snooker. And they were all pretty much stoned by that time. And they were all taking turns to hit the balls, all that sort of thing. And somehow or other, one of the naval people thought that the Gurkha people were cheating. I don't know why he thought that. But anyway, a fight broke out. And one of the Gurkhas, he fell backwards and hit his head on the snooker table and fractured his skull. So, petty officer patrol, I had to take him up to the hospital. I had to try and find out what had happened. Nobody ever saw what had happened. Nobody knew anything at all about the accident. And I think it never got ascribed to anybody. Anyway, I took this bloke up to the nearby hospital in our vehicle we had, our shore patrol vehicle, and told the people what had happened to him, and I just had to leave him there and return to the Chinese Fleet Club. And I heard later, I don't know how true it is, I heard later he died of a fracture of the skull. But I don't know how true that is. I never saw or heard much more about it after that time.
And what was going on when you got back to the club?
Well, getting wilder. One of the shore patrol, strictly against instructions, had imbibed too freely. He got drunk himself and was starting to abuse the officer in charge of the patrol. And was getting very violent. So the officer said, you'd better take him back to the ship and get a replacement. So I had to take this bloke back down to the dockside again, get on one of the Liberty boats, take him back to the ship, explain what had happened to the officer of the watch, and get a replacement. Well, got the replacement back, and by that time I realised that Christmas, that gentle Jesus, meek and mild, was very much absent from the China Fleet Club. And it got worse. We had to had to break up fights and all that sort of thing. And it all finished up about 3 o'clock in the morning. And my last recollection of that was a couple of blokes staggering up to me and say, get us a rickshaw. So I said, well, where do you want to go? We want to get back to the ship. I said, well, it's only about 100 yards down the road. You can walk down there. We ain't bloody walking. We want you to get us a rickshaw. So I thought, well, I'll get them a rickshaw. So I got these two blokes a rickshaw to ride 100 yards back to the ship, back to the dockside. And the last I saw of them, they were fighting the rickshaw as they went down to the dockside. Of course, when I went back to the ship, I had to explain to the relief officer of the watch what had happened. He was changed by that time. And the chap in the shore patrol I'd taken back to the ship earlier had to, he was put on commander's report by the officer of the watch. Well, I just staggered into bed, and about 7:30 I was awakened. You've got to go and give evidence at the captain's table, because I realised then that the commander's report, the commander wouldn't deal with it, it was too serious an offence. So he remanded the man to captain's table in the morning. So Christmas morning of all times, I had to go to the down on the quarterdeck, and this boat was dragged along by the regulating petty officer and all the rest of it, the master at arms, and was charged with his offence by the officer of the patrol. And with great reluctance, I must admit, I had to give evidence. and say, yes, he was very abusive to the officer of the patrol, and he did threaten to thump him and all that sort of thing. And I brought him back to the ship, and here he is, sort of thing. Well, in the end, this bloke got 10 days cells. And that was the end of that episode for me.